Yes, good morning to you all. It is a distinct honor for Cynthia and I to be with you. We've been looking forward to this, and here we are. Now, looking at that schedule, it looks rather daunting. For me, I can't imagine how much more it would look for you who have to sit while I at least get to stand during this time. But maybe continuing the introductions just a little bit, I grew up in what would be called an old Mennonite family. And I don't mean they're old. I just mean that's the group of Mennonites that they'd be part of, what's old Mennonites. My mom and dad there and my three siblings, I'm the little boy, the little baby on his mother's lap here on this picture. And if any of you have read the book Vera's Journey, this would be the story of my grandmother, my mom's mom. We moved to South Carolina when I was 7, as I mentioned earlier, and I was placed in a public school. This was my 5th grade class, and I am on this side, front row, the little white boy there. Two of my heroes growing up were Sitting Bull, the Sioux chief that became famous during the Battle of Little Bighorn, and Thomas Edison. Cynthia and I were married 39 years ago, so next year is our 40th, and here is it's not a complete up-to-date picture of our 5 children and their spouses and our 15 grandchildren, but it's close to complete. And yes, we have been serving at Faith Builders for quite a few years now. There's a picture of our campus. And it's good to be here with Victoria, with your people. We really enjoyed having her with us the last 2 years. 8 sessions in this course or this presentation on Anabaptism as Worldview. And let me explain that I call it Anabaptism as Worldview, because this is not a historical approach to Anabaptism. So it's not Anabaptism as history. It's also not Anabaptism as a subculture. We could talk about that. It's not Anabaptism as a faith tradition, although that's part of what we're going to be talking about. This is Anabaptism as Worldview. So we need to come to a common understanding of what we mean by this word worldview and why this particular approach. So that is where I want to turn our attention to this question of what do we mean by worldview? There'd be a lot of different definitions we could give, but to help us think about that, I was paying attention last evening as people were gathering and just observing. As some of you clearly hadn't seen each other for a while, but you did know each other. And so I was watching how you would greet one another. And I saw handshakes and I saw hugs. And in some cases, there was a lot of just delight. The face was lit up and, oh, so good to see you again. But we have different ways of greeting. And so I'm going to, in this top circle, I'm going to put the word what. And when we think about greeting, that is what we are doing. We are greeting. So I'm going to put greet over here. And then I'm going to just take one form. And let's just think the handshake. That is one way to greet someone. You put your hand out, the other person puts their hand out, and you make connection that way, and maybe you shake a little bit. You move them up and down. And I'm saying, why do we do that? You know, isn't that kind of strange? Just put your hands out and connect them and move them up and down. What's with that? And of course, not everybody greets that way. Understand that at least in some of the regions in Tibet, that the way they do their greeting is to, you come up to someone maybe that you haven't seen for a while, and both of you will go. Well, that maybe makes as much sense as this. And then in Yemen, I guess they like to get really close because they get up and they bump noses with each other. In some cultures, to greet, you clap your hands. And in some, Thailand, you know, there is a bow. I think probably my favorite, I understand that in the Maasai tribe in Tanzania, that when they greet someone that they really respect, so it might be a good friend, it might be an elder, and they want to show that respect, they do a handshake, but they add something to it. And that is, they first of all spit on their hands, and then you shake. And someone asked one of them, why do you do that? And you see, that's a fascinating question that we can come to. What we're doing in all of these cases is greeting, but then how we do it can be so different. In fact, we've mentioned a couple different ones here. We said the handshake is one way. You know, a couple years ago, at least in America, I don't know about here, but we got used to greeting instead of shaking hands. It was the elbows touching. So we'll add that as another form. You can touch elbows as a form of greeting. And then we had this spitting. So three different how we do the greeting. But now we're moving to this question underneath it, and that is the question of why. Why? For those who have studied the handshake, they say it seems as if that it goes back to a time in which when we met someone, we weren't always sure of their intentions toward us. Were they kindly? Were they coming in peace? And so to put your hand out would be to say, I don't have a weapon. And for you to put your hand out is to say, I don't have a weapon. And to join hands without weapons, but then you do want to make sure there's nothing up the sleeve. So you shake it out. So the why for handshake, at least originally, is to say, I come in peace. And you know, I find that that's still a bit of the intent, a bit of the what's expressed when we shake hands. I'm coming in peace. Now, I think the reason we did the elbow touching a number of years ago is because we said we really want to take care of each other. We don't want to spread disease. And so the why there was a form of protection. But why would you spit? And this member of the Maasai tribe, he answered it this way. Oh, well, of course I would spit on my hand when I want to show honor and respect, because I wouldn't waste my spit on just anyone. So why spit would be to show honor. Now, it's this realm down in here, this why realm, that we're interested in when we talk about worldviews. So from there, let's just consider that underneath all of our behavior, everything that we do, including the way that we gather for a meeting like this, and the singing, the fact that we sing and pray, and all of everything that we do, how many times we eat a meal, the way we eat the meal, what we eat, everything, underneath it is a set of answers to this why question. And Paul, the Apostle Paul, writes about this set of answers in Romans 12, 1 and 2. But before we go there, I would like for us to, I have some handouts for these sessions. And so if the ushers could pass those out, if you need something to write with, I don't know if we have any pens or pencils that we can share or not, but the handouts are coming. I would say everyone is welcome to a handout that would like to have one. And this handout is for all of the 8 sessions. So it is it's a pack. Don't think that it's just for this first 45 minutes. Okay. So I said that Paul mentions this category of why in Romans 12, 1 to 2. And I'm going to begin in verse 1. I only have verse 2 there on your handout. But he says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. So without diving deep here into what Paul is saying, let me just observe that he's first of all saying, he's talking about the what. He's saying, I want you to offer your bodies to God. You're to live in a particular way, in a way that God is pleased. That's the what. And then he goes on and he says, do not be conformed to this world. That is, don't let your what come from a why that is shaped by the dominant culture. Instead, he says, be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve that which is good, acceptable, and perfect. And that language, good, acceptable, and perfect, is describing an alternative why for how we're to live our lives. So there's two whys. There's the why of the dominant culture, and then there is the why of God, which is good, acceptable, and perfect. And he says your life, your way of life, is to flow from that particular why. And this realm of what is good, acceptable, and perfect is the realm of worldviews. So that's what we're talking about. Now let me offer a couple comparisons and a definition for worldview. First of all, we could say that a worldview is the way that I understand, the way that I make sense of the world. As we walk through life, we're constantly seeing things, experiencing things, meeting new people, and so on. And we're thinking about that. What does this mean? Why do people do this? What we're doing there is trying to make sense of our experience. And the fabric, or the glasses, you might say, that help us to make sense of the world is our worldview. And so we say, it's like glasses. It's the way we understand the world. It's like glasses. I want you to listen to the words of the writer H.G. Wells. He said, there was a time when my little soul shone and was uplifted at the starry enigma of the sky. So H.G. Wells is saying, there was a time, I was a little boy, I'd go outside and I'd look up and I'd see the stars, and he said, something in me would just take my breath away. My soul would shine because of that. You see, he had a set of eyes. He had a worldview that when he looked at that, it caused him to wonder. It moved him to awe. But he's not done. He says, now, as an adult, as someone who's lived a lot, who's gone to university, who's really learned, he says, now I go out and I look at the stars as I look at wallpaper. Notice something, he's still looking at the stars, but something has shifted. What has shifted? It's the glasses that he's looking at those stars through, the way that he's making sense of what he's saying. And he moved from that being an awesome experience to one of, so what? What has changed is the worldview. A second comparison we could give is we could say that a worldview is the way that we define what is normal. What is normal behavior? What is normal ways of thinking about things? You see, you know, carpenters, they use a level to determine what is normal. Not what is cockeyed, what's normal. And that's what our worldview does for us. As we experience different situations and people and so on, our worldview causes us to evaluate other experiences and where we judge them and say, oh, that's abnormal or that's normal. Now, maybe to illustrate that, Randy Richards is a Christian teacher who teaches in a lot of different cultures. And he says he finds that in some cultures, particularly community-oriented cultures, that they take multiple choice tests differently than those in Western cultures. Now, what's the difference? Well, here it is. He says, and that in Western cultures, so this would be us, most of us anyway, that when we take a multiple choice test and we come to a question that we don't know the answer, you know, there's answer A, B, C, D, and then E might be all of the above or none of the above. But if we don't know the answer, what do you do at that point? Somebody say it? You guess, right? You guess. And so on a multiple choice test, you fill out everything. All the answers all the blanks have an answer in them. But what Randy Richards found out is that in some cultures, there were a bunch of blanks coming back on the test. And so he asked him, why is this? Why do you leave some of these questions blank? And they said, oh, Dr. Richards, we leave them blank because we didn't know the answer. And he said, but why didn't you guess? And they said, oh, no, because if we guessed, we might accidentally get it right. And you would think that we knew the answer, and we really don't. We would be deceiving you. Now, notice how their worldview, their level, was evaluating the way we take multiple choice tests. That's what our worldview does. Now, another definition. We could say that our worldview is the set of head commitments and heart commitments. What do I mean? Head commitments, heart commitments. And what I'm suggesting is all of us have hundreds, thousands of head commitments and heart commitments. But by a head commitment, what I'm talking about is what I believe, what I am convinced is true about the world. So that's a head commitment. I believe this. A heart commitment is what I value. This is good. It's what I love. Head commitments, heart commitments. What I believe is true about the world, what I think ought to be true about the world. So let me illustrate both of those. When I was a fourth grader, I showed you my fifth grade picture. This was the year before that, but same group of students. I remember our homeroom teacher was a lady known as Mrs. Sears. She was a tall lady, and she told us on the first day of class that I have to leave the classroom several times throughout the day, and I'll be gone for maybe a minute, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. You don't know how long I'm going to be gone, but I will return. And you won't know the time or the hour in which I return. But when you return, if anyone in the class is talking, the whole class will get a licking. Now, by a licking, she meant that we would all stand by our desks and put our hands out. And she would hit our hands with a, she had a rubber strap about this long, and she would sit there and give us three whacks on our hand. Now, on more than one occasion, she came back and someone was talking. And so we all stood up, put our hands out, all get our licking. On one of these days, I was feeling the injustice of it all. And so when she got to me, I said, "Miss Sears, this isn't fair." And she stops and she says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, it's not fair." I said, I was quiet. I wasn't talking, but I have to get a licking. And she says, "Boy, let me tell you something." Said, "In this world, the world you live in, the good have to suffer with the bad." And I got my licking. Now, Mrs. Sears had a belief about the way the world really is. So let's add that. It's a belief about the way the world really is. She was convinced that this world is a place in which your behavior does not change the results of what happens to you. Now, Stephen had a value about the way the world not is, but the way the world ought to be. Stephen was convinced that if he wasn't misbehaving, he shouldn't be punished. But our worldview is a combination of both. Our beliefs about the way the world is, it's our values about the way the world ought to be. That, one more part of our definition, that shapes what I do, and how I do it. So our worldview shapes our behavior, and we're right back to this. Worldview is this that determines both the how and the what. Now, another example. I'm told that in some cultures, I know that some of the tribal cultures in Turkey, that let's say what you want to do is compliment a newborn baby. You see maybe you're walking down the street, here comes some friends, they're pushing a stroller, and in the stroller is a little baby, and you come up, you look at the baby, and it's a cute baby, and you want to tell your friends, you know, you want to congratulate them, and you want to mention how cute the baby is, and so on. You have to be careful, because that's what you want to do, but you have to be careful how you do it, because you have some beliefs that shape how you're going to do it. So what you're going to do to compliment that baby, you don't say, oh, what a darling, beautiful, lovely child. You say, oh, your baby looks like a donkey. And it's not because that in this culture they think donkeys are particularly good looking. It's because they're convinced that the atmosphere is full of malevolent spirits. And these spirits are constant. They're interested, they're curious, and particularly curious about humans and what humans are up to. And they're watching us. And if they see a human smiling, they see a human happy, they say, ooh, you probably ought to do something there. It's an invitation to get to work. And so you would hate to draw the attention of these spirits to your friends by saying something really nice. So you say, oh, your baby looks like a donkey. That way the malevolent spirits hear that and say, oh, poor kid, has enough problems already. We'll let that one go. And so notice what's happening. Beliefs about the world are shaping not only what they do, but how they're doing what they do. That's what we mean by worldview. Now, I have found it helpful to use a tree to talk about worldview. The crown of the tree is our way of life. It's that realm of of what we do and how we do it. The trunk of the tree is where I would put beliefs and values. So it's the trunk is what supports our way of life. It's what supports the what we do and how we do what we do. And so it's the trunk that is our worldview. Now, this weekend, what I intend to do is explore a number of beliefs and values that have often showed up over the last 500 years in this faith tradition we call Anabaptism. Now, in thinking about where does our trunk come from? Where does our worldview, where do the answers to the why questions that shape our lives, where do they come from? And I'm going to put that down in the roots level. And I'm going to suggest that there are five primary factors that shape the answers we give to the fundamental worldview questions. The first set of influences, or these are nutrients, you might say, that grow the tree that is you. The first one are texts and songs. And anymore, I have to define what I mean by text, because I'm not thinking of what you would do on a phone. What I mean by a text is a statement, whether written or spoken, that is considered to be authoritative. It's considered to be true. So that's what a text is. Every group of people has their texts, their statements that they say, you can rely on this. For many of us, we grew up in homes in which the text, Jesus loves me, was considered to be true. You could bank on that. Jesus loves me. And you see, when we sing a text, that's when we give it additional power for shaping our beliefs and values. Every Easter at our church and in many churches over the last 2,000 years, something like this is said. In some churches, it's every Sunday. But this text, the Lord is risen. And then the response, the Lord is risen indeed. That's a text. And of course, text can be longer. For Christian people, the scriptures are a text. You can bank on that. For Americans, a text that's generally valued is the Constitution of the United States or the Declaration of Independence. I'm sure Ireland has its texts. Every group, every family has those statements you can bank on. So that's one way our worldview is shaped. Secondly, are stories and heroes. And I mean narratives that capture the imagination. Where once you hear the story, you keep thinking about it. And maybe as a young person, as a child, you even try to enter that story. I know as I read and read, I still read a lot. And I remember as a young person, I'd read about Robin Hood and I'd want to kind of act like Robin Hood. I mentioned Sitting Bull and Thomas Edison. So I tried to be an inventor. I tried to be a Native American. It captured my imagination. But the stories and heroes that we grow up with shape what we believe is true about the world and what we think is valuable, what is worth loving. Imagine the difference, the different shaping potential between a home in which there is, a diet of stories of great Christians, of missionaries and so on, versus a diet of military heroes, how that would shape what you think is valuable or good, the way that would be worth spending your life. Second way the worldviews are shaped. A third one, are symbols and images. This is one that I've just added in the last number of years to this presentation because I begin to realize more and more how, at least in our day and age, but I think it's always been this way, how certain symbols shape what it is we not just think, but feel. So that's the power of symbols. Symbols can almost bypass the mind and cause you to feel things just because you saw it. A symbol takes an idea, takes a value, takes a belief, and pulls it together into a simple picture that when you see that picture, you have a response. Marketers today know this. They know what I don't know what all of your symbols are here in this country, but for a while in the States, a Starbucks picture. That just created a certain feeling for some people if you're a coffee lover. But there's some historic symbols. If I were to, for Christianity, say the fish. But what about just a few simple lines And yet, if this was a Jewish audience, that would evoke tremendous emotion just seeing that. Okay? Symbols. And these symbols, they shape us. They shape what we care about. Another one of my favorite symbols of Christianity is the symbol of the basin, the bowl, and a towel. Foot washing, kneeling in front of each other. It captures those ideas of servanthood, the fact that we're all equal before Christ. That symbol captures that without needing to say much at all. And a fourth way that our worldviews are shaped are practices and traditions. Regular and repeated activities that carry value freight. You know, when I was in second grade, that was when I was placed in public school, every morning we'd walk into the classroom, kind of get settled, and then the teacher would say, okay, all rise, and we would stand, and we would turn to the corner of the classroom, and there would be a symbol, the flag of the United States. And then the teacher would say, let's now pledge allegiance. Now, before I went to public school, my older brother and sister sat me down and said, Stephen, when you go to school, there's going to be this opportunity to pledge to the American flag. But they said, we're followers of Jesus. And I'm not sure why it was my older brothers and sisters that talked about this, not rather than my mom and dad. But maybe they weren't quite aware. But anyway, they said, we're followers of Jesus, so we pledge our allegiance to Jesus, not to the flag. And so they said, when that happens, you can stand. They said, that's fine, but you don't pledge. But then everybody, the class would be there, and then the teacher would lead in saying, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which you stand, one nation under God, indivisible, for liberty and justice for all. See, it's some 50 years later, and I still know those words, because that was a practice that, even though I wasn't engaging in it, it was around me and it was shaping me. Notice the combination. There was the symbol, there was the text, I pledge allegiance to the flag. After we would get done with that, then we would sing, my country tis of thee, sweet land of liberty. And then sometimes the teacher would tell us stories of how, stories of Paul Revere and George Washington and a Francis Scott Key when he wrote the national anthem of the U.S. and so on. So you see a bringing together of all of these factors in that practice that we would do every morning. And I say, what are the practices that are shaping our children? What are those regular repeated activities? You know, one of the things that I did participate in growing up, and that is that family mealtimes were sacred in our home. We would eat, generally it was breakfast. I grew up on a farm, so we could do this, but breakfast and supper, we ate together. And it was always about the same time. But just imagine with me, just that simple practice of eating a meal day after day after day. Let's say it's only one meal maybe, but maybe the mother, if she's the one who likes to cook, make something attractive and enjoyable. Everyone stops their work, stops what they're doing. They come together. They pause together and turn their minds toward the Lord and recognize that all good things come from His hand. And then there's relaxed conversation. Maybe they talk about the news. Maybe they talk about the food, the events of the day, what they're wrestling with, thinking about, and so on. The values that are shaped by that practice are obvious and many. Loyalty to family. Maybe that money is not the greatest good, that taking time away from making money just to sit and be together as people is valuable. Feeding the soul, remembering the Lord, all of these are values that come together in that practice. I remember one of my teachers saying that when he was raising his family, he wanted to do it right. So after supper, he would bring out, this was years ago, he'd bring out the overhead projector, and he would lecture his children about the gospel and the way of the Lord and so on. And he said it was kind of tough. They didn't want to sit there and listen to him. And he said, you know, years later, looking back, he realized that it was the hour actually before my lectures that shaped them more than my teaching afterwards. Practices has tremendous power for shaping us. But then perhaps the most significant factor is the soil itself. And those are the significant people, those who have emotional connections, the ones that care for us, that sacrifice for us, and so on. And I would just say that a wise home, a wise church is going to take initiative. They're not going to just leave this to chance, but they're going to take initiative in shaping the way of life, the beliefs and values, and the underlying stories, practices, texts, and symbols. In talking with one of you last evening, you were just saying how that you did not send your children to the government education system precisely for this reason, because you know how strongly that can shape the beliefs and values. In 2004, the day after Christmas of that year, and some of you are old enough to remember this, off the west coast of Sumatra in Indonesia, there was a 9.1 level earthquake. It triggered a series of devastating tsunamis bordering the Indian Ocean. And we know that a tsunami is this displacement of water often caused by an earthquake. And in deep water, what this does is cause a very fast-moving wave. But as the energy reaches shallower portions, closer to land, the speed decreases, but the height of the water increases a lot. And in 2004, the earthquake storm surge was over 100 feet above normal. It's a tremendous wall of water coming in. This ship, the Aipung 1, weighs 2,600 ton. And they say it was just kind of picked up and flung inland about a mile. But then there it sat. And they really didn't have a way to get it back to the water. So it's still there. You can visit it. It's a tourist attraction. But on a much more sobering note, over 230,000, a quarter million people died in those tsunamis. We return to our passage in Romans, because I believe there is a spiritual tsunami mentioned here. Look for it. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. There is a why. There is a worldview. There is a set of beliefs and values that aligns with what is true, with the way the world really is, with what is good, acceptable, and perfect. There is also a worldview that is deadly. It offers wrong alternatives to what is true and good. And Paul calls it the pattern of this world or the spirit of the age. And he says that this is trying to push us into its mold, to shape us, to overwhelm us, to tsunami us. It was this way in Paul's time. It's that way in our time. So in one sense, this is nothing new. But we do face a spiritual tsunami in our time. And it's a tsunami that threatens to overwhelm our set of beliefs and values. But not just that, to replace the stories, the texts, the heroes, the practices with those of the dominant culture. We are drinking from so many different wells today, through the internet, through books, podcasts, and so on, that it's not surprising that our worldviews are diverging, that it's hard for us to get on the same page, for us to see the world and then to live in the world in ways that align. Paul instructs us, do not be conformed to the worldview of this age. Resist that pressure to take on the worldview of the dominant culture. But I ask the question, where do we get the power to resist this kind of force, this kind of tsunami? And that's the question that we want to pick up in the next session.